The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
As humans, we are uniquely qualified to tell you about it. Okay, I have to start my little recorder here. Sorry.
Just got a tech.
During the last presidential election in the United States, Bernie Sanders shocked the American political establishment by declaring his candidacy for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination while openly embracing a peculiar and taboo label, one that had long carried such a dreadful stigma that any politician who embraced it would surely be excluded from the realm of political relevance. He declared himself to be a socialist. Gasp. In the years leading up to Sanders' announcement, national polls had showed a significant shift in public attitudes, particularly among people under the age of 30, in the direction of favoring socialism and disfavoring capitalism. But the shift evaded the attention of official liberalism and mainstream political commentators until Sanders' campaign created a vehicle for its expression in the arena of official politics. Since Sanders' surprisingly narrow defeat by the powerful Clinton machine, the socialist cat has only come further out of the bag of forbidden political ideas. In the UK, the recent success of the Labour Party in its national elections, under the leadership of a self-described socialist Jeremy Corbyn, has sent even more tremors through the political establishment in Europe and North America. Back in the United States, the membership and general audience of socialist organizations is larger than it's been in many decades, as expressed by the record-breaking attendance at this conference, for example. So the specter of socialism is back, enchanting the minds of the oppressed and haunting the oppressors, but it has also brought along with it the old myths about the alleged impossibility of socialism. Among the most common of these myths is the idea that socialism is nice in theory, but impossible in practice because, after all, it is incompatible with human nature. This is a particularly persistent retort, at least on its face, because the world in which we live, one in which oppression and exploitation pervade nearly every aspect of our lives, appears as one in which a society without these features must indeed be impossible. Certainly, anybody who has spent any time talking about socialism among people who are not socialists will have some experience with this argument, and therefore it's important for us to take it up seriously. So that's what we're doing. So in this talk, I'm going to respond to three questions. One, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about human nature? Two, what have Karl Marx and other important socialists had to say about human nature? And three, is the classical Marxist position on human nature compatible with contemporary science? And then Haley is going to talk about how this plays out in our daily lives under capitalism and how it might be different under socialism. So first, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about human nature? Very frequently, debates about human nature are unproductive because the contending sides have approached the question from such fundamentally different positions that they're not really talking about the same thing at all. Accordingly, it will be useful to begin with clarifying our terms and developing what exactly we mean by human nature, so that's what I'm doing now. As scientific socialists who are attempting to understand the world in order to change it, the starting point of our analysis must always be the physical world and its laws of motion, which we believe exist independently of any conscious awareness or understanding of it. Starting with the sensory information that we receive from the world around us, we construct mental categories which allow us to grasp certain truths about the world reflected in our minds as thought. For example, upon interacting with the world and taking in some sensory information from it, we observe that certain living objects that we encounter share particular important qualities, the quality of being tall, the quality of having many leaves that create shade, or the quality of being made of a hard material, and so on. And so we mentally group together these objects that share these qualities under the name of tree. That is, in our scientific view, a tree is a tree simply because we have named it as such. We have created a theory of trees, and not because there is any metaphysical spirit or essence of tree that exists outside of our consciousness. This is not only the scientific approach for developing a theory of trees, it's also the scientific approach for developing a theory of human nature. We start with real, living, breathing people and develop ideas about what human beings are like in general, which is understood to be a set of defining behaviors and qualities which are found in all humans. This is what Marx is expressing in his thesis on Feuerbach where he writes, "Human nature is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. In reality, it is this ensemble of social relations. So what does he mean by the ensemble of social relations? Against the idea that there's something that exists in every person simply by virtue of being human, something like a human soul or the spirit of humanity, Marx is arguing that human nature should be understood as the whole range of relationships and behaviors that belong to those creatures which we call human beings. So once we've dispensed with the idea of a supernatural human soul, it becomes more clear that, just like all of nature, human beings do not exist independently and separately from our relations to each other and to everything else in our environment. In fact, we might even say that human beings do not merely have relations to other things, but that we literally are our relations to other things, and that as social beings, we are our social relations. And starting from this notion of human nature as being the ensemble of social relations, if social relations change over time, and they do, then our conception of human nature must also change along with them. And human nature does indeed drift in the currents of historical development, but it is not without an anchor. In a footnote in his masterpiece, Capital, on the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, Karl Marx wrote that to understand human nature, one must first deal with human nature in general, in other words, the anchor to which human nature remains affixed throughout all places and times, and then with human nature as modified in each historical epoch, or human nature as it drifts with the currents and tides of historical change. Underlying this distinction between human nature in general and human nature as modified in each historical epoch are really two distinct but interrelated aspects of human nature that I think are still really useful and that we should use in our own exploration of what we mean by human nature today. The first sense of human nature, which corresponds to human nature in general, refers to the qualities which exist throughout the entirety of our history. I take this to include a set of needs, behaviors, and qualities that exert various pressures which shape human beings in all times and places, but also importantly, especially for this talk, importantly to include a certain state or a potential state of existence that human beings are especially adapted to, are driven to, that we actively seek out and struggle toward when we are denied access to it or we are alienated from it. It's a state that resonates with our fundamental physiological and psychological needs and which reduces our suffering. This is the sense in which the artist Frida Kahlo was using the word human when she said, "I am more and more convinced that it is only through communism that we can become human," alluding to the idea that humanity is a condition that we are currently denied, but that we aspire and strive toward. The second sense of human nature that I'm going to discuss corresponds to human nature as modified in each historical epoch. I take this to reference the set of behaviors and needs that are particular to each phase of economic and historical development through time and in different places. These various human natures, which are plural, are distorted expressions of human nature in general, contorted by the material conditions in which they arise. These include the needs, behaviors, and qualities that are characteristic of humans as they are expressed in a distorted way under various particular modes of production and stages of social development. Of course, we are particularly interested in human nature under capitalism. Indeed, the very idea of human as something that is distinct and deserving of its own word is actually the product of various historical developments. Even today, you'll get a different answer about what the word means depending on who you ask. The common sense notion of the word changes from place to place and throughout time. Typically, it implies that something that is human and not merely an animal or a machine, and accordingly ought to have certain dignities and rights. As a result, its meaning is a battleground in the class struggle. In virtually every social struggle against oppression and exploitation, the idea of humanity is more or less pervasive, even if it is not always made explicit. In fact, I think a convincing argument might be made that the opposite of being treated as human or being dehumanized is more or less synonymous with being oppressed. For example, a popular slogan in the civil rights movement in the United States was, "I am a man." This was a claim to humanity, to being human against the dehumanizing treatment of racists. Or when a woman is sexually harassed on the streets and asserts in response, "I'm not a piece of meat," she's asserting that she's a human and not merely an animal, or a dead animal in particular. A worker who strikes to resist their treatment as tools or as components of the apparatus for turning out capitalist profits is making a claim to humanity and rejecting their treatment as mere machines. A disabled person who insists on their own autonomy and entitlement to dignity is resisting their exclusion from the category of human being or of being treated in a way that is dehumanizing. If the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of class struggle, as was written in the Communist Manifesto, then it might be added that the history of all hitherto existing class struggles is the struggle of the dehumanized to seize their own humanity. So to answer the question succinctly, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about human nature? For the purposes of this presentation, we're not talking about an abstract or supernatural human soul or essence. We're talking about a set of characteristic qualities that are used to define what we mean by a human being, as opposed to something that is not human, and which changes throughout history as the result of both changing social relations and changing ideas about what kind of relations get to be included as human. Next question. What have Karl Marx and other important socialists had to say about human nature? I should preface this section by saying that there are important debates within Marxism about humanism and anti-humanism, primarily around the French philosopher Louis Althusser and his assertion that there was a so-called epistemological break between Marx's earlier writings and his later writings. But I'm not really going to weigh in on that here, because I mostly think Althusser is wrong. But it could be really useful to come up in discussion, because it's out there and it's a debate. When Karl Marx's close comrade Friedrich Engels spoke at Marx's funeral in 1883, his speech included one very long run-on sentence that I think brilliantly summarized Marx's legacy and his worldview. I'm going to share the quote and then break it down piece by piece in order to discuss how it relates to other things that Marx said about human nature. My hope is that this will give us a sense about what Marx thought about human nature in a way that shows how it was really embedded in his worldview more generally. So what Engels said was, "Just as Darwin discovered the law of development of organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of development of human history. The simple fact, hitherto concealed by an overgrowth of ideology, that mankind must first of all eat, drink, have shelter and clothing, before it can pursue politics, science, art, religion, etc., that therefore the production of the immediate material means, and consequently the degree of economic development attained by a given people or during a given epoch, form the foundation upon which the state institutions, the legal conceptions, art, and even the ideas on religion of the people concerned have evolved, and in light of which they must therefore be explained." So what does all of that mean, and what does it have to do with human nature? He starts by invoking Darwin and claims that Marx discovered the law of development of human history. That is, he immediately implies that development and change are central to Marx's worldview, including his ideas about human nature. For example, in his polemical book, The Poverty of Philosophy, Marx goes so far as to declare that, quote, "all of history is nothing but a continual transformation of human nature, even if that transformation is indeed anchored," and I think Marx absolutely believes that it is. He goes on to say that mankind must first of all eat, drink, have shelter, clothing before it can pursue politics, science, art, religion, etc. That human beings must first of all eat, drink, have shelter and clothing before it can pursue other matters alludes to those qualities that earlier I included in the notion of human nature in general, or the qualities to which human nature must be anchored at all times. These correspond to basic needs and drives that are shared with animals and which tie humans immediately and necessarily to the rest of nature. In Marx's manuscripts, which were published in the German Ideology, he writes, "The first premise of all human history is, of course, the existence of living human individuals. Thus, the first fact to be established is that physical organization of these individuals and their consequent relation to the rest of nature, which he says includes natural conditions that are geographical, hydrographical, climatic, and so on." So he establishes that human nature is fundamentally rooted in the physical world and that human relations to the earth and to the geological processes on which we depend for our survival are included as part of what humans actually are. But of course, although our animal functions, as Marx calls them, are part of our human nature, he does not believe that we are merely animals. There's more to the story. Again, in the German Ideology, he writes that humans can be distinguished from animals by consciousness, by religion, or anything else you like. They begin to distinguish themselves from animals as soon as they begin to produce their means of subsistence, a step which is conditioned by their physical organization. By producing their means of subsistence, humans are indirectly producing their actual material life. Elsewhere, he writes, "Admittedly, animals also produce. They build themselves nests, dwellings, like bees, beavers, ants, etc. But an animal only produces what it immediately needs for itself and its young. It produces one-sidedly, while man produces universally. The animal produces only under the dominion of immediate physical need, while man produces even when he is free from physical need, and only truly produces when he produces in freedom therefrom. An animal produces only itself, while man reproduces the whole of nature." The truth in this statement that man reproduces the whole of nature is all too obvious today in the age of climate change, ocean acidification, human-made mass extinction, and so on. Indeed, it is becoming widely accepted that there has already been a qualitative break in the geological epoch that we're living in, typically measured in at least tens of thousands of years, and that many now argue that we are living in the Anthropocene, a period of in the development of Earth's natural systems in which the determining factor in geological processes is human activity. It would seem that all the way back to 1844, Marx was onto something very, very important. Essentially, what he argued was that the defining and central feature that distinguishes human beings from other animals is our labor. Of course, animals also perform labor, but whereas animals only perform labor instinctively and only to meet their direct need, human beings consciously reshape the entire world around us. We consciously plan our labor, we imaginatively invent and use tools that increase our capacity to transform the world around us. The anchor of human nature in general compels us to consciously appropriate objects outside of ourselves in order to shape the world to our own needs. We're determined to be masters of our own labor process and the products of our own labor, and this does not primarily occur on an individual basis. If we are driven to consciously transform the world according to our own imagination, then we are also driven to cooperation, if only because through cooperation our transformative powers become greater. Unfortunately, in the world we live in today, we're clearly not masters of our own labor or its products. On the contrary, we're enslaved by the products of our labor. Rather than directly controlling our own labor process in order to produce for our own needs, our labor in capitalism is controlled by our bosses and directed toward the production of commodities which don't belong to us. They belong to our masters, to the capitalists. From the exchange of commodities arises a whole complex system of money and capital. Capital is the product of our collective labor, and yet we are dominated by it and subjected to its will. We produce for the needs of capital, that is profit, and not for our own. Just as our natural human drive to control our own labor and its products are distorted under the exploitative relationships of class society, so too have we become distorted humans. Whereas outside of class society, we need food, under capitalism, we need money to buy food. Whereas outside of class society, we are driven to produce for ourselves in order to maximize our own freedom, under capitalism, we're driven to produce for the employers and to forge our own chains. Whereas outside of class society, we're driven to cooperate in order to maximize our transformative powers, under capitalism, we're driven to destroy each other and in order to compete for the crumbs left behind by the exploiting ruling class. This is the tortured expression of human nature as modified in the epic of capitalism. But for all of the evils of capitalism, it contains within it the seeds of liberation. In the form of the working class, capitalism conjures up a social force with both the objective interest and the power to transcend it and to abolish all exploitative social relations. As Marx said, what the bourgeoisie produces above all are its own grave diggers. How does this happen? For various reasons, particularly due to the competition between capitalist firms on the market, capitalists are compelled to constantly invest in the development of new technologies and as a result develop the means for humans to liberate ourselves from dehumanizing toil if only we can wrest these tools from the blood-soaked hands of the capitalist ruling class. In the preface to A Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, Marx writes, "The productive forces developing within bourgeois society create also the material conditions for a solution of this class antagonism. The prehistory of human society accordingly closes with this social formation." What a peculiar phrase. My high school history teacher said that human history really began with the rise of agriculture, and yet here's Marx saying that we are still living in the prehistory of human society. What Marx means by this is that the abolition of class exploitation, specifically through a working class revolution to overthrow capitalism, can break through the fetters and chains that have constrained, tortured, distorted, and mutilated our core human nature as it has been modified in each historical epoch of class society. And it's through this process, as Frida Kahlo said, that we can become human. But this transition through socialism toward a classless, stateless society, that is communism, is not a simple return to the primitive communism of pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies. Certainly, I hope not. Such a thing would be impossible and, for me, undesirable. No, this will be a fully automated, luxury gay space communism. in which we will collectively take control of the wonders which we have made and to use them to go where no man has gone before. Or, as Marx put it, this communism, as fully developed naturalism, equals humanism, and as fully developed humanism equals naturalism. It is the genuine resolution of the conflict between man and nature, and between man and man. The true resolution of the strife between existence and essence, between objectification and self-confirmation, between freedom and necessity, between the individual and the species. Communism is the riddle of history solved. Well, that all sounds very nice, doesn't it? But does any of this jive with what we actually know about the biological evolution of Homo sapiens? That is the third question. And due to a lack of time, I'm not going to be able to get into that question, but I will very quickly, in the next like 2 minutes, lay out some quick thoughts in broad strokes and point to some resources that are much better than what I would actually be able to say right now anyway. From an evolutionary standpoint, our most important adaptation is adaptability. We can live in almost any environment that exists on Earth or in any social system that we enter into. The special sauce of our biological evolution that sets us apart is that our big brains afford us the incredible flexibility to adapt to new conditions, importantly through the cooperative use of tools and the use of language. We are neither innately saints nor demons, but we are capable of becoming either or both. We're capable of being both lords and serfs, slaves and slave drivers, bosses and workers, and this incredible flexibility, in fact, is the result, in many ways, of our biological evolution. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to say much more about this, but I want to share some like quick resources on this because as a scientist and as a scientific socialist, I think that what contemporary science has to say about human beings is really, really crucial. There is a talk that Phil Gasper gave last year at the conference on human nature, so just go to wearemany.org and search human nature, and he goes really into depth about like the kind of evolutionary biology and anthropology about human development that is really, really super useful, and I really encourage everyone to go listen to that talk. And I think what the gist of it shows is that despite Marx not having access to much of what we now know about human evolution and our biological development, his views on human nature actually resonate incredibly well, even shockingly well, with scientific perspectives today. There are also a few books in the Haymarket room. Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind, and Not in Our Genes, Biology, Ideology, and Human Nature, which I have actually not read either of these two books, but I'm going to, obviously I bought them. Because we all read all of the books we buy, right? and with that, I'm going to wrap up and hand over to Haley.
Tyler. So I'm going to start with an anecdote. I am a law student at a university that has a range of graduate programs. We have a graduate student lounge, which is a communal space with big tables where students study together. On a particularly busy day last semester, I could hardly find an open seat. But fortunately, I found a classmate of mine at a big table by herself. Relieved, I asked her if I could sit down, and to my surprise, she said no. It's not that she didn't want to share, she said. It's that she had gotten there early, so she didn't have to share. And so I was confused and disheartened, so I just walked away. I found another table crowded with people I had never met before, with books and laptops, with one empty chair. I was a little nervous, but I asked if I could sit down. They smiled and said yes, and they made space for me. These, of course, were sociology students. On its face, we could understand this example to say something about the basic nature of law students. As Marxists, as Tyler said, we have to look deeper. So remember those students. We'll come back to them. The first article in the credo of capitalism is that you cannot change human nature. We are inherently violent, competitive, greedy, intolerant, fearful, hierarchical, and capitalism, they say, is the very expression of our nature. This is the pinnacle of our society. So that to try for anything else, to organize for anything else, is hopeless. Which is suspiciously convenient for those who want things to stay as they are. But the question of human nature is not a rumination for its own sake. It must be answered urgently. The ruling class today is destroying the planet that we live on. They control the medicine, food, they have nuclear weapons, and they're playing a little fast and loose with them. Each day, though, more people are rejecting the violence, rejecting destruction and inequality of capitalism, but are still hesitant to embrace socialist politics because of the question of human nature. And if it is natural for us to engage in relentless competition, to wage endless war with each other, and to destroy our own surroundings, any attempt to change it is pointless. If, on the other hand, we are capable of coexisting, coordinating, planning, and we want to continue life on this planet, we had better find another way. Capitalism has created abundance and the conditions for the fullest expression of human nature, and yet prosperity is denied to all of humanity except a tiny minority. The ruling class drives fast and beautiful cars, own multiple homes, they attend the best schools, they learn art, they learn music, they travel the world, they drink exquisite wine. In contrast, the majority of people struggle from day to day to make ends meet, live paycheck to paycheck, rent crappy, burning apartments, send children to underfunded and overcrowded public schools. They fear going to the doctor because of our crippling debt, and most of us don't drink exquisite wine. Capitalism fails to meet the basic needs of billions of people. And yet, this is the expression of our human nature? I'd say capitalism, in failing to meet our needs, stunts human development. So for the next 20 minutes or so, I will talk about capitalism, and we'll talk about socialism, and I will talk about the implications of each system on our nature. So the first question is, why do so many working class people believe this is our nature? Even if they themselves don't feel, they don't wake up feeling greedy and violent. To answer that, let's take a look at where ideas are perpetuated. Now, the 1% we know owns and controls the media, owns and controls education systems, textbooks, so their ideas get the broadest hearing. Marx wrote, "These ideas of the ruling class dominate in every era. They become the ruling ideas." So, next question, why would the ruling class want us to believe that we are violent and greedy and fearful? It's actually not because they're all like Montgomery Burns, like up in his estate, you know, like planning how to control all of us. It's actually more complicated than that. It's in their material interests as a class to bolster the belief that the system reflects our inevitable nature. Capitalists subsist on profit. It's how they exist. Profit is the driving force in capitalism, and that means getting out more than you put in. The basic framework of capitalism is class exploitation. The ruling class subsists by exploiting the labor of workers. Exploitation makes profit, paying workers less than they produce and skimming the fat. Underpaying workers makes profit. Under capitalism, human productive capacity has increased so much that we could easily provide for everyone on the planet. We produce more calories per capita today than ever before. Yet, across the world, people are dying of hunger. In past eras, crises were caused by drought or blight, when not enough goods could be produced to meet the needs of society. But under capitalism, crises come from overproduction, when too much is produced to sell at a profit, which is ridiculous. If we make more than we need, we should all get a vacation. To the capitalist, profit is God. Profit over safety, profit over health, profit over education, profit over peace, profit over the planet. If they cannot profit, they will destroy, wasting food when the world is plagued with hunger, leaving houses empty when people sleep in the street. Unsold, brand new, beautiful cars rotting in rows in random fields because they couldn't be sold before the next model came out. So why do people believe that human nature makes us fit for the system? It's not only that the ruling class says so, it's that people see it in the news, they feel it in their lives. We do have to compete for jobs. We do have to compete for places in schools. People even sort of have to, like, compete for cheap toys at Christmas time. This is part of our lives. Strict hierarchies dominate at work, in the government, at church, in school. Anti-immigrant terror and hysteria leads people to believe that a clash of cultures is just natural. Karl Marx wrote, "The human essence is no abstraction in each individual. In its reality, it's the ensemble of social relations. The idea there is that changing the social relations can change the human essence." So let's check back in with our grad students. A law student must compete for a small number of high grades. It doesn't matter how you perform objectively. It matters how you perform compared to your classmates. The stakes are real and they are high because job offers depend largely on grades and student debt is steep. It's not in the best interest of a law student to help her classmates. Sociology students, on the other hand, learn in a collaborative setting. High grades are not scarce, and even though it's true that unemployment and debt are unquestionably and unreasonably high, the field encourages peer review and resource sharing. It's sociologist. It's not surprising that the notion that humans are inherently fit for capitalism is touted by free market economists and splashed all over the mainstream news. This perspective is very beneficial to capitalists. Our terrible nature lets them off the hook and blames inequality produced by the system on our natural differences. Some people are naturally smart and ambitious and climb to the top, and the loans they get from their parents have nothing to do with it. So it only makes sense that some of us, lazy and whatever, are stuck in the mud at the bottom. This perspective of human nature takes some qualities that some humans have and conflates them as natural. Fortunately, there's an upside. Capitalism, by its very method of exploitation, creates its own demise, its own grave digger. By putting a group of people in a workplace and compelling them to work on a common project, you're teaching them how to run the show collectively. Add in terrible working conditions, speed-ups, plummeting wages, more hours or longer hours or not enough hours, and you've created a group of people who know how to collectively run schools, hospitals, factories, bus routes, restaurants, and you've given them compelling reasons to take it over and run it and make it work for the majority and not a tiny parasitic minority. This is what Marx meant by the working class as the class with revolutionary potential. But people do not, as we know, inevitably come to this conclusion. It seems in this world today, humans are not ready and not able to create that kind of world. Right now, we're actually not. We are mired in the muck of ages: sexism, ableism, insecurity, racism, competition, conformity. Capitalists use those ideas to divide us, and when they divide us, they conquer us. A society focused on everyone's needs would encourage and nurture the good qualities that exist in us. And every day, more people, today millions of people, are looking for a way to make that society real. Millions of people are looking to socialism. So let's all take a closer look at what socialism means. So there are many different and often clashing definitions of socialism. I'm sure you've heard them. I've heard that socialism is Canadian healthcare, it's German universities, it's like North Korea. Someone told me that socialism was the Marines. When I say socialism, I don't mean the Marines. I mean something very simple, that the resources of society should be used to meet people's needs. Seems so obvious, right? There are empty houses and homeless people, wasted food, starvation, advances in medical technology and medicine, and people who need them. Under socialism, the means of production would be owned and controlled by the majority, by workers. Under such a system, it's important to say there would be a much greater number of workers actively participating because there would no longer be the barrier of competition for jobs. Everyone has talents and can do things. No one would live in squalor because of disability or age. Capitalism is marred by intellect never developed, talents never appreciated, and the distinctively human capacity to engage in creative, socially useful work is reduced to a commodity worth only as much as the capitalist can pay and still turn a profit. Socialism is a planned economy. Take profit out of the equation, and we could prioritize education for its own sake, technology that enriches our lives, going to space because it's cool. We could access our healthy food. Nobody wants to eat as much corn as we have to eat under capitalism. When profit ceases to be a motive, humanity will have to reprioritize our attention, refocus.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.